Okay, so I'm going to talk about becoming an alder member. First of all, a little bit more in principle, and then look at the practicalities. So, becoming an alder member means you've decided that you're a Buddhist and that you want to put the Buddhist vision of what it is to be a human being, Buddhist understanding, Buddhist values, right at the centre of your life, and allow everything else, relationship, families, work, lifestyle, to be informed by those Buddhist understandings, values, and so on. Usually this is something that happens gradually, a gradual shift that takes place over quite a time, but you reach a point where that's very clear to you. It's the Dharma that you want to stand right at the centre of your life. So there's been a process then of a deepening, assimilation and understanding of the Dharma from an initial meeting with Buddhism, initial inspiration and enthusiasm to a deeper appreciation and realisation of the implications of taking these teachings and practices seriously, so that one's come to the point where there's a strong, powerful inner imperative. This is what one has to do and keep on doing for the rest of one's life and even beyond. So that's the first, if you like, sort of principle. Becoming an order member means that there is, you've reached the point where you recognise there's this powerful inner imperative that one has to commit oneself to the Dharma. One has to put the Dharma at the centre of one's life and keep on doing that. That's the only way to really live. And then, secondly, one's decided that it's this particular community, the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, Western Buddhist Order, this Sangha, with its specific teachings, practices, approaches, that one wants to work out that commitment to the Buddhist path. Whatever looking around, shopping around, exploring that has felt necessary and appropriate has been done. One's decided that this is the place, the order, the movement, the Sangha, the people, where one is going to work out that commitment to the Dharma. So that means one trusts that this order, movement, the teachings, the practices that we have are an effective path to enlightenment, a path that can actually work, take one all the way to enlightenment. And yeah, well, obviously, there wouldn't be any point in joining this order, the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, if one didn't have confidence in this, that this does provide an effective path that can take one all the way to enlightenment. So that broadly is what it's going to mean to become an order member. You've decided you really want to put the Dharma firmly, clearly at the centre of your life. Not simply that you want to do it, that you have to do it. That something in you just knows this is the only way to live. There's this powerful inner imperative. And that one also has decided that this spiritual community, this Buddhist community, is the one in which one is going to work that out. So, let's just then look at the practicalities, at it in a much more sort of immediate way. So I'm going to talk now about the whole process of becoming an order member, particularly from the perspective of the order in the UK and Europe. There are independent trainings, preparations for ordination in India, in the USA, in Australasia. We do aim through the College of Public Preceptors to try and make sure there is a real unity and shared standards and approaches, but there are going to be differences due to the very different circumstances, particularly in India. You know, it's a very different world there, so the way in which one might approach ordination is going to be a bit different. So I am speaking from the perspective of the UK and Europe, just to make that clear. So first of all, one has to ask for ordination. If you want to become an order member, you have to ask. And this is just very important. It comes from you. It's what you really want to do, feel you need to do, have to do. This request is going to be ritually made again in both the private ordination and the public ordination ceremonies, underlining the fact that it is a real individual choice and act. But there's the fact that you have to ask. You can ask any order member and they will direct you to the ordination team and one of the public preceptors, and it will be the College of Public Preceptors who make the final decision, and one of the public preceptors who performs your public ordination ceremony. So when anybody asks for ordination, we're informed here at Padmaloka. We keep the register of requests in Britain and Europe here. And we also have taken on, when anyone asks for ordination, to respond formally. So we'll send out a letter, a handbook, and a bit of an explanation of the training that we offer here at Padmaloka. And the ordination team here will then be working quite closely with local order members to try and provide you with whatever is needed. So again, just to sort of set things out as clearly as possible, some years back there was an initiative to set up parallel ordination training processes so that it wasn't all just focused on Padmaloka. So there was also going to be a training focusing at Vajraloka and also one at Dharmavastu, which was the then study centre based at what is now known as Vajrakuta. Dharmavastu actually moved and then transmuted, so that process disappeared very quickly, never really happened. And the Vajraloka one also didn't really work out, never really took off. What we do have now are some embryonic independent ordination trainings, still very embryonic, in Germany, in the Low Countries, in Scotland, in Spain, working together with us at Padmaloka, but actually beginning to unfold. The Spanish-speaking process is probably the most developed. Mokshananda, who's one of the public preceptors, also visits Mexico and Venezuela. And he's regularly, over the years, come here with groups of Spanish speakers and joined in working with the team here. And then went on to run his own fully Spanish-speaking retreats. Bodhi Mitra, who's here, has come regularly with Mitras from Germany, preparing for ordination. There's this sort of sense of working together, sharing in the experience that we have here, and then just slowly, and now quite organically, beginning to work out independent processes. So again, there's Dharmarati is starting to develop retreats and so on in Scotland, but still we work very closely with him, and people from Scotland come here as often as possible. And similarly with the Low Countries, there are hopes of actually in time establishing an independent training there, but as yet it's very early days, and we're still looking to work together very much with people from these different places to help over time. But it does take quite a time actually to build up the experience and understanding for there to be independent trainings. We've realised, I think, after that early experience with the attempt to have independent processes at Vajraloka and Dharmavastu, that we need to go much more slowly and build up these independent processes much more organically. And so at the moment, a lot still does can't fall back on Padmaloka, you know, in terms of offering a systematic training. One of the things that has been going on here in terms of, as it were, spreading things out as well, we've been inviting experienced order members from all around the movement to come and work together with us. So again, we've got Bodhimitra and Sangaloka and Nandavajra here with us on this retreat, and probably on every retreat you come there'll be a number of experienced order members who are coming regularly, you know, maybe once, twice a year, working with us on these retreats, taking back the experience of the team here to their local centres and helping build up a real sense of the team here working together with order members from other centres to support your ordination training, the deepening of your going for refuge. There's also the Mitra Conveners meeting. The Mitra Conveners meet here regularly with Padmavajra. By all accounts, those meetings are very effective. People find them very encouraging, inspiring. And again, the Mitra Conveners go back to their centres, their key men in terms of helping set up facilities for your ordination training back in your centres. So it's another way in which we are trying to work very closely with other order members to provide what you need to support your going for refuge. So a very important part of becoming an order member, training in the Dharma on the way to ordination, is coming on these going for refuge retreats at Padmaloka. We do offer several, 6 or 7 every year, and these retreats do mean they're a chance to get to know the ordination team here, a chance for them to get to know you, so they can then be in ongoing dialogue with local order members about your needs, progress, and so on. Coming on these retreats is also a very good way of connecting with the wider Sangha of men who are preparing for ordination and building up a much broader sense of what the order and the movement are outside of your local centre, local Sangha. If you've been around a while, you do start to appreciate that each centre does have its own particular flavour. There's a lot we share, but there's also each centre does often have its own particular flavour, its own particular atmosphere, and it's very good to get a sense of the whole order and movement and the very different flavours, if you like, that are possible within our order and movement. It's worth also noting that if you don't come on retreats here, it's actually very difficult for us, in terms of the ordination team, to have a real sense of you and be able to take any initiative in really supporting your going for refuge. Once you're coming here and coming here regularly, we do get to know you, we do clock you, and we do really try to engage with the local order members and really try to do all we can to support your going for refuge. But if we don't see you, it is very difficult for us to have you in focus and be able to give that sort of support and encouragement. So as well as the going for refuge retreats, there are cooler gatherings, which again I think are very valuable in terms of just getting to a sense of the wider order and movement, the wider Triratna community, Buddhist community, Sangha. There's one straight after this retreat, which hopefully a lot of you are going to be staying on for. Then the other aspect of coming on these retreats is just going much more deeply into what the order, the Dharma, a Dharma life, a life in the Dharma is all about. And going into it in a much more focused and essential way that's often going to be possible back at home. But we do have, you know, these retreats, a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, where we really can go into, you know, what is the order, what is spiritual friendship, what, you know, what are ethics, and so on, just in a very focused and concentrated way, and yeah, really try to get to the heart of things. So, for all these reasons, coming to Padmaloka can be, for most people, a very important part of becoming an order member. So we do encourage and urge you to come as often as possible. Yeah, certainly, you know, in theory, it's going to be possible to cover all the ground, all the issues, all the areas that you need, as it were, to prepare for ordination without coming to Padmaloka. But in practice, I think that's going to be very difficult, if not impossible. So yeah, it is going to be very valuable, and I think for most people essential to come on these Going for Refuge retreats. That said, the real ongoing preparation for ordination takes place back at home, in the midst of your everyday life, work, commitments, relationships, so on. You know, that's where most of your life is lived. You know, you may come here for 2, 4, 6 weeks a year, but you know, for much of the rest of the year, you're back at home. That's then where the foundations for an ongoing, sustainable, effective life in the Dharma have to be laid and built. Now that's where the work goes on. So this order that you're looking to join is spoken sometimes as a network of spiritual friendships, you know, a living network of spiritual friendships, vertical and horizontal, something that's fluid, alive, constantly unfolding and deepening. By the time you're ready to enter the order, you'll hopefully be woven into that network of spiritual friendship of Kalyana Mitratta. So part of the process of becoming an order member is building, developing friendships based around these shared Buddhist values, shared values in the Dharma, shared commitment to the Three Jewels. Building friendships with more experienced order members, with people like yourself, also training for ordination, training in the Dharma, building connections and friendships with those coming into the centres, coming into the spiritual community behind you, with whom you can actually begin to share something of your own understanding and experience as you support classes, retreats, and centre activities. So yes, this whole process of becoming part of this network of spiritual friendships, where there's an obvious and deepening connection, you might actually want to formalise it as a formal Kalyana Mitra relationship. You might want to ask two order members to be your Kalyana Mitras. When you ask an order member, they'll check it out with their local order members and with a public preceptor, and then when that's all been done, when the chapters have discussed the appropriateness and everyone is happy, then you can ask a public preceptor or a private preceptor working, as it were, under the tutelage of a public preceptor to perform the Kalyana Mitra ceremony. It's a very simple ceremony, but something very, very meaningful. So it's not compulsory that you have Kalyana Mitras. You know, it's not a sort of absolutely essential to have formal Kalyana Mitras. You know, it's definitely not something to be grabbed after. You know, don't get into the must-have Kalyana Mitras, who can I sort of get approach to things. But it is definitely something to bear in mind, you know, in terms you are trying to build these real, warm, open, honest connections with people. And where those start to come more alive with order members who you feel, you know, real respect and connection with, well, you could think about formalising it as a formal Kalyana Mitra relationship. And formalising it does seem to make a difference. It does seem to add a dimension, a strength, a depth to those connections. You know, it really adds, as it were, another dimension to something that's already present, already happening. At some point, probably when you're already well on in the whole process of training in the Dharma, preparing for ordination, you'll want to ask someone to be your private preceptor. And it's worth saying here, this isn't something to start worrying about too soon. Again, it's not something to chase after. It's not really till you're well into the training, where ordination starts to, you know, start to have a sense ordination may be somewhere on the horizon, you know, maybe in the next 2 or 3 years. You know, that might be the time to think about asking someone to be a private preceptor. Sometimes, you know, asking too early, it can just be a bit artificial. And, you know, as time goes on, you might actually discover actually much more meaningful connections develop. So it's much better just to leave it to take its time and you know, not be in a great hurry. I'm sure you'll get a nudge if you're leaving it too long. So you can ask any order member who's been at least 10 years in the order to be your private preceptor. It's always a good idea, though, to check first with a member of the team here or, you know, more experienced order member around your centre. But certainly with a member of the team here is always good if you want to get a sense of how appropriate it is. If you ask an order member, well, why I say that is, you know, we just have a certain perspective. You know, we can have a sort of sense of those order members, if you like, who are well embedded in the order, those who are maybe a little bit less well connected and who it's not going to be so straightforward for them to actually enter into the responsibilities of being a private preceptor. If you ask an order member who's already been appointed as a private preceptor, they'll still need to check it with their local order members and with a public preceptor before saying a definite yes. So, you know, don't be disappointed if somebody says, oh, great, but I need to think about that and talk to my chapter about it and just check it out, because that's what we ask people to do. If they haven't already been appointed as a private preceptor, but the local order members and the public preceptors they chat with think, yeah, it's appropriate, then there's a whole process of consultation with the order that goes on, and this can go on over a number of months, where order members are actually invited to give feedback to the prospective private preceptor about their strengths and weaknesses and so on. This can be a challenging, but I think also very fruitful, and usually very fruitful, encouraging and inspiring process. And I think mostly it has been the case, you know, that people have actually found it, you know, it's really taken their own practice up a few notches, just having to meet the challenge of this. So Yeah, there have been some cases where it's just got rather sticky and uncomfortable as well. So once the consultation has gone on, a private preceptor is appointed by the college. They also need to attend a training retreat. It is quite a big step for anyone to become a private preceptor, a big responsibility for them to step into. So once it's all set with your private preceptor, they'll be working with you, helping your preparation. Some actually come on, if he's going for refuge retreats, with the men they intend to ordain in time. And the private preceptor particularly will then be in quite active dialogue with local order members, with us and with you about, you know, the areas you need to work on, the retreats you might go on, the gaps in your study that you might fill in, and so on. So hopefully they'll be there for you to really help give you some sort of real guidance, encouragement in working out and filling out your training. And this connection will carry on after ordination. And we talk about, you know, sort of approximately a 5-year period where your private preceptor really tries to work with you quite closely in terms of, you know, looking at retreats, study, what you need to do to really help consolidate and establish yourself in the Dharma, in your going for refuge. You don't have to ask anybody to be your public preceptor. That's sorted out for you. The public preceptors work in coolers of at least 5 public preceptors. There's one that sort of includes 4 of us here at Padmaloka, and then 2 or 3 others, and then there's another that's sort of more or less Madhyamaloka based and draws in others. But then we also sometimes, for the men, there are those two coolers in the UK and Europe. And then there's also other informal coolers that come together, you know, for specific cases and people. The public preceptors between them work out who actually performs the final ceremony. Part of the reason for this is just logistics. You know, at the last Gukyaloka course, I think we had 18 or 19 men being ordained, and there were 14 or 15 private preceptors, you know, because people had asked different people to be their preceptors. But and you could imagine if people were also asking different people to be their public preceptors, it would just be a logistical nightmare. So, you know, just for that reason as well, we do try to keep things quite essential and simple. So, like at the moment at Padmaloka, Satyaraja is our main public preceptor. He's the man doing the public ordinations from Padmaloka over the next 2-3 years or whatever. I did a stint just before that. So we're just trying to, as it were, in that way, essentialise the work, the job of the public preceptor. So you don't have to worry about asking anybody to do that. That's looked after for you. So the local order members, you know, in time, maybe your Kalyanamitras, your private preceptor, the team here, you know, will all be talking with you, getting to know you, exploring your Dharma life with you, giving feedback where appropriate, hopefully plenty of encouragement. And as time goes on, there will be formal discussion in chapters amongst the order members who know you. Reports will get sent to us at Padmaloka, and we'll enter into discussion with local order members and really just be looking at, you know, to do all we can to bring things together for you. So you know, this whole process tends to intensify as time goes on, and as you get more deeply into the Dharma, you know, as your own going for refuge deepens, so the amount of interest and involvement by others will increase. And yeah, we do try to have a bit of an overview here, certainly on, you know, where everybody is up to, and keep a, you know, a sense of where you are in terms of moving towards ordination. We will try to keep out quite a focused awareness on the men in training and how they're progressing, and as time goes on we will be engaging more deeply with you in close dialogue with local order members. So this sort of quiet intensification goes on. Don't please ask order members to actually tell you if you're ready. They may tell you if you're not, but we actually encourage order members not to say they think you're ready until there's real consensus in the order, and you know it's sort of time to send an invitation out. What we found is if order members do start saying, well, I think you're ready, that can set up a real polarisation between them and those who don't think you're ready. And you do get people sort of saying, well, so-and-so thinks I'm ready, but you know, what's wrong with those others? They're just blocking me. You know, and actually people, well, you know, sometimes your friends, those closest to you, really want to see you ordained, and they're trying to be encouraging, but you know, there's others maybe who just see you a bit differently and just see that there's some other things that you could do a bit more work on. And we just don't want to set up painful polarities and confusion. So, you know, don't expect people to be telling you you're ready. You know, just be happy with encouragement to keep on doing what you're doing and with working with whatever feedback you might get. So there's going to be these various areas in which we want to see you training, gaining, increasing clarity and depth and understanding, effectiveness in your practice. And these are set out in the this handbook that you get sent when you ask for ordination. And actually each year we send you out from Pavloka a new edition, setting out the retreats for the coming year. So there are these different areas in which we want you to have really have explored as part of your preparation for ordination. And yeah, they're set out under these various headings in the handbook. So the first area that we mention in the handbook is going for refuge. So we want you to understand the meaning of going for refuge to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. You know, to have a real sense of the Buddha, a real sense of what the Dharma is, of the Sangha. A real sense of what it means to put this going for refuge into practice in the midst of your life. There is that well-known quote of Bhante's that going for refuge is primary and lifestyle is secondary. But lifestyle is also very important. And so going for refuge is going to involve just really looking at your life. You know, looking at how you're living your life, looking at what you're doing with your life and how your going for refuge can find expression in your relationships, work, everything that you do. And sometimes this does throw up quite big questions, you know, in terms of how one is living one's life, what one is doing with one's life. Many people nowadays coming into the movement and the order come with careers, come with families and so on. It's not a matter of sort of dumping all of that and, you know, moving into men's communities and right livelihood businesses. That may be the right life for a few people, but nowadays it does seem to be very much more of a minority who are choosing that lifestyle of communities, working full-time for the Dharma and really working for the centres and so on. But whatever your lifestyle, it's going to be something you really need to look at very deeply and fully, how you're living your life, how you're living out your life. And hopefully there will be at least some, you know, who really do want to work very fully for the Dharma, who really want to give their lives very fully to the Dharma, and maybe choose not to go down the road of career and family and so on. And yeah, we certainly want to give all the support we can to those who do choose to live that way, as well as to all of those who you know, come already with family commitments, work, whatever, that doesn't make that possible. But, you know, within the commitments that one already has, you know, how then can one more and more effectively live out one's commitment to the Three Jewels? How can one give expression, you know, to one's feeling for the Three Jewels in that life? So that's something that you're going to want to be really exploring with your spiritual friends, in study groups and discussion groups. You know, really becoming as clear as you can how the life you live is going to be a life in the Dharma, and give expression to your deepening commitment and unfoldment within yourself of the Three Jewels. So then the second heading, what is the order? That's what this retreat is, isn't it? So actually, yeah, really trying to get a clear sense of what the order is, you know, what this Triratna Buddhist order is, in all its different sort of levels and dimensions and so on. You know, just being very clear, you know, it's not a Buddhist club, it's not a society, it's not a spiritual support group. You know, hopefully having a much more robust and challenging vision of what this order is, and a real sense of committing oneself to creating the order. You know, a real sense that this is something one wants to help create, wants to help unfold in the world, and yeah, a deepening sense of understanding what it is going to mean to do that. And that means, you know, on the one hand, both a realistic sense, you know, not one doesn't enter into the order rosy, you know, with a sort of rosy romantic ideas that are just going to then get very disappointed when you meet the reality, you know, of order members struggling to make sense of themselves, of their lives, you know, that phrase of messes in progress, you know, here we are, you know, we bring to the Dharma all our confusion, all our difficulties, and there they are, you know, writ large in what happens when we try to sort of live and work together. So there's that side of things, but then there's also, you know, just not losing sight of, well, just the fact that there can be something very remarkable happens in the friendships, in the connections that we build in the Dharma. Yeah, something quite mysterious and wonderful that can unfold, that there is this vision of the other order, as Padmavajra spoke, you know, that we are actually creating together, as well as, you know, just the very positive, real human warmth, connections, care, understanding, love that can be there as well, and often is there between order members. So, you know, one has a realistic sense of what the order is, as well as keeping alive that sort of vision of what it is we're trying to create together. The third theme we want you to explore in the process of becoming an order member is spiritual community and spiritual friendship. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of overlap, isn't there? In a way, we only do one theme here. You know, it's all going for refuge. We just approach it from slightly different angles. So, spiritual community, spiritual friendship. Well, what is friendship? One thing I've noted over the years that you know, people can have a very limited view of friendship. You know, people can have one model of friendship somewhere in the mind. There's just this one model of what friendship looks like. Sometimes quite a romantic, idealized model. And we actually need to have, if you like, much more flexible understanding of the very many different shapes that friendship can take. You know, some friendships can be very matey, others can, in a way, have almost a more formal aspect to them, but they can all be very valuable. You know, there can be friendships with people the same age as yourself, friendships with people much older or younger. There's all sorts of possibilities there in friendship, all sorts of flavours and shapes. And I think it's very important to have this sense of possibility in friendship and not approach our idea of friendship and spiritual friendship with a very fixed view. And again, I think there's something really important to explore. You know, what are the models of friendship we have and how far are those actually limiting and defining the possibilities of friendship that are able to unfold in our life? So then there's the whole area of ethics. You know, at the time of ordination, one takes on the 10 precepts, and you know, we explore those very fully when we study the ten pillars. You know, that paper that Banti presented to the order back in 1984, and again, we really want to enter into very fully what it actually means to practice the precepts, to really enter into the practice of the precepts, you know, understanding them not simply as rules, but as well, a whole path of unfoldment that we can enter into more and more deeply, supported by practices such as confession and the making of vows and resolutions and so on. So, you know, again, you know, part of preparing for ordination is going to be really trying to enter into the spirit of what it means to practice the precepts, as well as, you know, just looking at our lives in a very practical way. You know, all sorts of, you know, very practical questions. You know, vegetarianism, you know, our sexual ethics, alcohol, gambling, pornography. You know, all of these sort of questions. You know, what we do with our minds. You know, what we do with our speech and the way we behave, and the effect they then have on our spiritual life. You know, just really seeing into those our actions and their consequences in a very clear way, so that we can really start to have a sense of how we can steer ourselves in a much more effective way on the path. Then the area of wisdom. You know, there are these three levels of wisdom that are traditionally spoken of: listening, reflecting, and meditating. And you know, the first level, listening, really involves getting a very clear understanding of the Dharma, of the teachings, and particularly the emphasis given by Bhante, by Ajahn Sangharakshita, you know, the particular emphasis, the particular way that he presents the Dharma, being very clear about that and how those teachings can work in our lives and how we can work with them. So, yeah, this means having a regular study practice, individual, hopefully study groups back at centres, as well as coming on, you know, retreats here and really entering into an understanding of the Dharma much more sort of deeply and effectively. And maybe also taking advantage, you know, of what's on offer with Dharmapala College and so on, you know, the study that's available elsewhere in the order and movement. And just also learning to reflect, learning to really make the Dharma our own, really turn over the teachings, really enter into them. You know, all of this is a very important part of our preparation for ordination, of our establishing ourselves, you could say, on the Buddhist path. With that actually being confirmed, if you like, with ordination, or affirmed with ordination. So then meditation. So, again, part of preparing for ordination, establishing ourselves in an effective, going for refuge, involves developing an effective meditation practice. Learning to use meditation to work on our mind, with our mind. Seeing our habitual tendencies, seeing how we can begin to work with them and change them and free ourselves from them. So it involves developing a quite workmanlike, consistent meditation practice. And again, I think it's very important to be able to see the difference between a workmanlike, consistent meditation practice and having meditation experiences. You know, some people have quite strong experiences in meditation and can give a lot of stock to those, but they can remain sort of experiences, somehow isolated from the whole work of transformation. So what we really want to see in terms of people's meditation practice is they know how to work with their mental states. They know how to work with their states of mind. You know, they don't get stuck in anger, resentment, craving, whatever. They know how to work with their states of mind. That's what we're looking for in terms of an effective meditation practice. And yeah, just looking, you know, through the teaching available in the order and movement, the retreats available. You know, there's meditation retreats here available at Vajraloka and elsewhere. You know, a lot of actually very good meditation teaching available that you really need to take advantage of. You really need to get on meditation retreats and enter more deeply into meditation and really know how to work with your mind and mental states. So that whole aspect then of training and preparation. The next theme is that of the Bodhisattva path. We could say the altruistic dimension to going for refuge. And again, that's something we do see as absolutely crucial. In the Tibetan tradition and Mahayana teachings, they speak very often of the two wings of enlightenment. You know, the bird of enlightenment has these two wings of wisdom and compassion. And a bird with only one wing is useless. It just can't fly. And it's something that Bhante has emphasized again and again, you know, the inseparability of wisdom and compassion. That you can't actually live the Buddhist life selfishly. It's a contradiction in terms to think of insight, which is seeing through the distinction between self and other, transcending the distinction between self and other just for yourself. You know, we can't have a selfish Buddhist life. That's a contradiction in terms. And we do live in a very sort of individualistic age with a lot of emphasis on the, you know, me, mine, myself. You know, that's the whole thrust of so much, you know, that goes on in the modern world, advertising and so on, sort of attitudes around. So we really do have to work against that and really try to see very clearly you know, the need for the unfoldment of that other regarding element in our lives. If we're going to have a sustainable spiritual life, a sustainable Buddhist life, a really effective Buddhist life, yet if we're going to be able to hold wisdom, then we need to be kinder, friendly, more generous individuals. And yeah, that's going to mean, on a very practical level, just living less selfishly. And you know, that will hopefully also find its expression in helping out in the local centre where you're from, helping spread the movement, helping spread the Dharma. Then the final area in which we ask you to prepare, you know, the final theme that we mention in the handbook, is the area of faith and imagination. So, yeah, again, it just seems very important. You know, we can talk a lot about Pratitya Samuppada, about the order, about going for refuge, but there's another dimension also needs to be present, and increasingly present, in an effective Buddhist life. His presentation of the Know Your Mind material on the retreats that he ran some years ago, Subhuti spoke of faith, Shraddha, as not being an essentially Buddhist faculty, but in fact a deeply human faculty. You know, it's a faculty present in every human being. It's that in every one of us that wants to be more, that recognizes and responds to the good, the beautiful, the true, and wants to move towards it. So this faculty is there in all of us. But all too often, you could say, in life, people mistake this urge to be more, this urge to go beyond present limitations, you know, in terms of just having more money, you know, a more beautiful wife, more power, more influence, rather than actually recognizing, you know, that it's an urge to go beyond all limitation, an urge to true freedom from all greed, hatred and delusion, from all ideas and everything that limits. And yeah, it's very important to begin to recognize this faculty within us, value it and educate it and inform it. Now again, Bhante speaks of faith having these three elements of intuition, you could say, this deep response to the higher, the good, the beautiful, the true. But then we have to educate and inform that intuition through our reason and through our experience, so that we can clarify what it is, you know, where it is that true response, and where, you know, our fears and desires and so on start to distort and colour it. It's also very important we can distinguish between faith and devotion. Bhante, in Know Your Mind, he makes this very interesting distinction between faith and devotion, and points out how sometimes devotional feelings can be quite superficial, you know, quite light, bubbly, exciting, beautiful, but actually quite superficial, whilst faith can be much quieter, much steadier, less dramatic, you know, less touchy-feely, but actually a very important current stream in our lives. And I think a lot of people mistake the two. They think because they don't have immediate devotional feelings, they haven't got faith, they haven't got Shraddha. But actually, there can be a lot of Shraddha there. You know, there can be something very deep in us that really is looking for something, really wants something more in life. And we undervalue that movement in ourselves because we don't recognize it as Shraddha, don't take it seriously enough, because we're looking, as it were, in the wrong place for Shraddha. We're looking for devotion. Devotion can be an expression of Shraddha. And again, Bhante makes a distinction between the devotion that is a way of cultivating Shraddha and the devotion that is just a natural expression of Shraddha. And yeah, the two, I think, can look and feel quite different. So that's something we're going to be looking for as well. And, you know, hopefully you're going to be looking for that. There is, faith has awoken, that you recognize your own faith. You value Shraddha in yourself. You're allowing your Shraddha to become more and more that sort of directing current in your life that you listen to. You know how to listen to that faculty of Shraddha. You know how to nurture it and value it. And yeah, that Shraddha then sort of allows us to touch this mysterious realm of undefined meaning. You know, allows us to be moved, allows us to enter more and more deeply into the world of the Dharma, drawing, you know, these deep emotional parts of us along on the path. On the retreats where we explore the whole aspect of faith, the imagination and so on, we do particularly give a lot of emphasis to the going for refuge and prostration practice. And we actually do that practice on most of these going for refuge retreats, but it's given a particular focus on those retreats where we really enter into this sort of mythic context as we speak of it. And again, so doing the going for refuge and prostration practice allows us to begin to enter into this other dimension of the Dharma, and for that all to be present and alive for us. And I think it's just so essential for us Westerners, with our very rational tendencies, to just to be able to bring our emotions in, but in a way that isn't irrational. You know, that our faith does have the support of our reason and experience. So yeah, that's another very important part of this work of preparing for ordination. Other things that are mentioned in the handbook, just one I'd pick up on, is solitary retreats. You know, again, something very valuable is just going off by yourself and just being with yourself for, well, you know, you might just want to start off with a long weekend, but then in time a week, 2 weeks, even longer. But there's something I think can happen when you are just with yourself. Not just sort of hanging out, but also, you know, practicing, being present in the Dharma with your aspirations, and just seeing yourself, being with yourself more fully and deeply. So, yeah, I think a solitary retreat is a really essential part of preparing for committing yourself fully and wholeheartedly to the Three Jewels. You know, just being able to be happily and positively with yourself. In all your sort of glory and warts all together, you know, just being with yourself, a very, very important part of this whole business of preparation. So broadly, being ready for ordination will mean having caught the real spirit of the Dharma, of our order. You know, it's sometimes said that the real spirit of the Dharma, the real spirit of the order, has to be caught, not taught. Talk some years back, so Bhuti spoke of Padmaloka as a sort of infection centre, you know, where you could come and sort of catch the spirit of the order. One's faith, one's Shraddha in the Three Jewels will be alive, unfolding, established. You'll know yourself well enough, know your strengths and weaknesses, to know what you need to do to maintain an effective spiritual life, and the conditions that you need to put yourself in to sustain your going for refuge. Your life, livelihood will be sorted out, stable, so that you're able to really focus on preparing for, assimilating, ordination. So this will mean there's no big debts, no big difficulties, no big confusion in your life that need to be addressed. All of that should be addressed before, you know, really thinking about ordination. And you will have started to really be part of this network of spiritual friendship that is the order. So this, along with all that covered, looking at these different areas that need to be addressed in training, when all of this is in place, a consensus is reached among the order members who know you and the public preceptors, then there'll be an invitation to an ordination retreat, to which you'll need to respond. You know, you'll have to say, yes, thank you. For most, that will involve an invitation on a four-month course at Gukyaloka. And yeah, these four-month retreats at Gukyaloka are an incredible opportunity not to be missed. You know, it really can be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, though hopefully for many there will be more longer retreats as time goes on. And again, this will often need quite a bit of thinking about planning ahead, saving up, getting everything in place so that it's possible when the time comes to actually go off for those 4 months. And yeah, just to be clear, it isn't just down to personal preference and inclination. You know, if it's at all possible, we want you to go to Gukyaloka. You know, it's not that you can sort of, well, I think I'd rather not. It's not like that. You know, if it's possible, you go to Gukyaloka. Of course, there are going to be some cases because of family commitments, health, age, and so on. It means it's just not possible to spend 4 months in very basic conditions in a mountain valley in Spain. But again, just don't be too quick to assert that you can't go to Gukyaloka. You know, when I was writing this talk, I thought immediately of three people over the last few years who started off absolutely convinced it wasn't possible for them to go to Gukyaloka. Eventually they realised, you know, with some help, that it was possible, that it was going to be possible. They went, and each of them said afterwards they wouldn't have missed it for anything. You know, they were very, very clear afterwards. They just wouldn't have missed it for anything. They were really grateful that they did go in the end. And also, you know, just the changes that took place in them on that course, you know, couldn't really have happened in any other way. If, though, you know, if you really can't go to Gukyaloka for, as I say, very good reasons of, you know, young family, health, age, whatever, we will do all we can to help you get ordained. And there are regular 2-week ordination retreats here at Padmaloka each year. And you know, in other cases, other arrangements are also made. There are great advantages in being ordained with others, you know, being part of a little cooler, little group of others all ordained together. There's, yeah, something very special about being part of a cooler, which is why we do have these retreats once a year here for all of those training with us who can't go to Gukyaloka. And in those cases, again, we really try to plan ahead, get the invitation out very early, and get the private preceptor to plan a whole series of weekends, solitaries, other retreats, over a whole year, if possible, to at least some degree duplicate all the elements of the ordination course that happens at Gukyaloka. So I hope you get the sense from what I've said that ordination isn't something to be hurried, isn't something to be chased after, but rather given time to grow into, unfold, apply yourself wholeheartedly, yes, but not rush. And I think it's also worth bearing in mind that ordination isn't an end. In a way, it's just a beginning. You know, there's a whole process of training and preparation that leads up to ordination. But this is all intended to help establish you firmly and clearly in your going for refuge, in an effective spiritual life, Buddhist life, which will continue then to deepen and unfold through the rest of this life and whatever future lives there may be there waiting to be lived.